Immigration changes on hold as Cuba talks go forward. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. We'll discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making those headlines. A federal judge in Texas puts a stop to President Obama's executive action on immigration for the time being. 26 states have sued, including Florida, leaving millions in the lurch. Round two of talks with Cuba are set for next week in Washington, D.C. Will the U.S. press its case on human rights? As the measles outbreak sparks another debate over vaccines, how well vaccinated are South Florida school kids? And tens of thousands of Floridians want a statewide constitutional amendment vote on solar power here in the Sunshine State. It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup next on WLRN. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Andrew Hanen is a federal judge in Brownsville, Texas. It's where the Rio Grande empties into the Gulf of Mexico. And this week, it's where President Obama's executive action on immigration came to a standstill. The judge issued a preliminary injunction, a temporary stop to the president's plans to defer immigration action against about 5 million people in the United States who are here illegally. The ruling gives 26 states, including Florida, more time to try and stop the president's immigration plans entirely. President Obama defended his policy to reporters in the Oval Office on Tuesday.
I disagree with the Texas judge's ruling, and the Justice Department will appeal. This is not the first time where a lower court judge has blocked something or attempted to block something that ultimately was shown to be lawful. And I'm confident that it is well within my authority and the tradition of the executive branch's prosecutorial discretion.
The Texas judge ruled the Department of Homeland Security instructions for immigration officers to defer action is, quote, a massive change in immigration practice, and the change in rules violated the normal process. The president's plan to expand DACA, deferred action for childhood arrivals, was to begin this week. The president's DAPA plan, that's deferred action for parents of Americans, was expected to begin this spring. Diego Ramirez is an undocumented immigrant protesting the Texas judge's ruling in Little Havana on Tuesday.
Is this a political strategy trying to put fear in our communities? But we still have hope, and we're still going to get all the people who are eligible for DACA Plus and for DAPA to get ready.
Armando Carrada is among those who was not deported thanks to the 2012 program that deferred action against immigrants who were brought into the U.S. illegally as children. Because of that deferred action, he was able to attend Miami-Dade College.
No one should be afraid because it's just a tactic to scare the community and make those that qualify not go and apply for DAPA or the expansion or DACA.
The immigration ruling may have come from a judge in southernmost Texas, but it can be felt here in South Florida. Will this ruling stop immigration reform? What's the status of the millions of undocumented immigrants and the hundreds of thousands here in Florida? Does the immigration debate impact your family? Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup as we begin with immigration today. 1-800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, online at WLRN.org, or on Twitter, send us a tweet at the handle at WLRN. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Sergio Bustos is the political editor for the Miami Herald, joining us from the Herald's newsroom. Tim, first of all, the immediate effect of this Texas judge's ruling is to put a temporary stop on the executive action. What's the next step for immigrants that are left in the lurch?
Well, lurch is the good word. I mean, we're in limbo right now, and what you're going to see is the courts right now testing the legality of President Obama's executive action. He, as you just heard, insists that they did all their dotted all their I's and crossed all their T's. They're insistent that this is a legal executive action. But you know, I guess a good analogy would be gay marriage. Oddly enough, I mean, when we had all these states declaring that gay marriage bans, and then that went to the courts and the constitutionality and the legality of those bans was tested, and we're seeing the results of that now. I think conservatives in this country are now doing much the same thing with the president's immigration order. They're going to take this to the courts and test the legality of what he did.
Now, this was a very narrow ruling in this case. It was regards to the rules that the Department of Homeland Security issued back in November. It didn't test the entire legality of the executive action. But Sergio Bustos, what's at stake for these 26 states that are suing, Florida included? What is it that they would like to do other than the executive action the president has put forth?
Well, I think what's happening now is you're seeing this legal fight. And as Tim says, it may be a good comparison to gay marriage, but keep in mind, this could take months to resolve. Now, I know that advocates have pressed the Obama administration to request what would be called a stay on the judge's orders, which would allow people to at least begin applying. And again, just to recall, there may be 10 to 11 million illegals in the country, undocumented immigrants, and not all of them are even eligible for this executive action. Right. It's about 5 million. So this could take a long time to resolve, and I know that the advocates have become pretty impatient.
Tim, we'll get into some of the specifics about what the executive action sets forth. Of the 4 to 5 million estimated immigrants that could fall under the executive action if it were allowed to go forward, how many in South Florida do we know?
In South Florida, about 85,000, and that's a good chunk of the 250,000 in all of Florida that could be affected by this. In Miami-Dade County alone, you're looking at about 50,000.
So these are the folks that are left in the lurch now because the executive action has been stopped. What are the goals of that executive action, this deferred action against parents and the expansion of the deferred action of childhood arrivals?
Well, I think the goal of the action on the president's part, which he announced in November right after the disastrous midterm elections for the Democrats, was to go back and try to, the overall overarching goal, and I don't know if Sergio would agree with this, but was to get immigration reform jump-started again in this country to sort of lay out, look, this is where we need to be going in terms of fixing our broken immigration system, starting with these, you know, as they call them, the dreamers, the kids who were brought here by their parents and, in all legal fairness should be allowed, according to them, to stay here. And then expanding that to other undocumented immigrants who have, who don't have criminal records here, who have made lives here, et cetera. So what the executive action was trying to do was trying to break that logjam that we're suffering right now in this country with, in terms of immigration reform.
One of the former leaders of immigration reform back in the previous Congress was, of course, the junior senator from the great state of Florida, Marco Rubio, Sergio Bustos. He certainly is not out in front and center on immigration reform these days, instead busy fundraising and potentially looking at a 2016 White House bid. But where does the senator come in as the Texas judge's order puts a stop for the time being on this executive action from the White House?
Now, like any politician who's ever gone out on a limb on immigration, Senator Marco Rubio got punished pretty harshly. And now in the midst of a presidential bid, more than likely, he's not going to be out there again and kind of tempt the conservatives that really fight him on this. Well, what's interesting, though, is even Jeb Bush has come out and said, let's do something. But everything at this point, they're letting the judges rule and kind of let the courts do what they need to do in this. But again, I think the ball is in Obama's court now to try to appeal and get a stay of this particular decision so that millions of people can at least apply for this. And again, temporary status. It's not permanent status.
It's deferred action. It's deferred action, which is delayed action. And the courts are doing what the courts do, which is look at the law and look at the executive action. But the legislators, supporters of immigration reform, are saying are doing what legislators ought not to do, which is complete gridlock and inaction in this case. Let me go to the phones real quick, Sergio. Hope is joining the conversation from Miami. Hope, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Putting all politics aside and leaving the subject of legality and budgetary pressures aside, how could we ever say no to immigration reform when our Statue of Liberty reads, give me your tired, your poor, your hodo masses? It doesn't say give me those that can pay for the documents in the United States. And as a child who came alone through Mexico from Cuba, I can tell you it is a desperate need to simply just reform immigration. So I am 100% with that.
Hope, we appreciate the personal story there. Hope as a immigration reform supporter. And Sergio, we hear a number of voices like that, certainly from South Florida. Is that carrying any more weight when it comes to that political gridlock over this issue that we continue to experience in Washington?
Tom, not to sound like a politician, but I will. You know, everyone is right on this issue. Yeah. As the caller mentioned, you know, in her case, I don't think she came to this country to do any wrong. A lot of people are escaping, out of economic necessity coming here. On the other hand, the conservatives are right because the rules have been broken to enter the country. But if you look deeper, immigration in general in this country, just the whole legal system of getting into the country has been, it's in pretty bad shape and needs vast reform.
And what we're seeing politically, Tim, is Democrats on Capitol Hill, and we're seeing this in the national stage, pointing to Republicans and say, if not the executive action, then what?
Well, exactly. And that's going to become a much more pertinent question in Florida, because it used to be, well, immigration didn't matter here because Latino immigrant in Florida meant Cuban
right.
And that, it, you know, who cared? Because
and
they were
now
getting,
there's even thoughts about, you know, rethinking the Adjustment Act, of
well,
course,
well,
and the wet foot, dry foot policy.
Exactly. So things are getting very complicated, especially because the Latinos that this does affect, Mexicans above all, who are 2/3 of the Latino population in this country, their numbers are growing very strongly in Florida. We've seen a 40% increase in the Mexican population in Florida over the past decade. So that is creating a pressure on both Democratic and Republican lawmakers in this state to start addressing this issue seriously for the first time in really Florida's history.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here on WLRN. Sergio Bustos is the political editor at the Miami Herald. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. You can join the conversation at 800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN on Twitter. Send us a tweet at WLRN. Now, immigration, guys, it's not on the agenda when the U.S. and Cuban diplomats are expected to sit down again for their second round of talks next week in Washington. This is round two of these negotiations toward the effort to normalize relations. Second time around here since President Obama announced that strategy back in mid-December. These talks come after the U.S. has taken a few more steps now to open up the economic ties with the island, easing the travel restrictions. We've seen those 12 categories come out and specific rules around what made in Cuba products and services can be imported here into the U.S. So, Tim, what do we know about this second round of talks? What specifically is on a high on that agenda? What's prioritized for American diplomats?
Well, what's not going to be on the agenda are these sort of hyper issues that we've been, you know, chewing over the past couple of weeks.
Human rights.
Well, human rights on the U.S. side and Raul Castro's, you know, demand that we return Guantanamo, you know, on the Cuban side. What we're going to be seeing again in the second round is what we saw in the first round, which is, you know, diplomats sitting across a table and going at the nuts and bolts of reestablishing diplomatic ties. That means reestablishing embassies, getting ambassadors seated. And the things that, you know, the U.S. cares about is just, you know, unrestricted travel for their diplomats to be able to go around Cuba, meet with anybody, including dissidents. Cuba, it's also, you know, mundane stuff. They want to be able to travel around, and they want banking.
Right. The Cubans
access
want
to banking.
Banking, right.
Yes.
Because, Sergio, the Cuban representatives who are in Washington and those through the United Nations in the United States have not been able to bank in the United States for the better part of a couple of years now.
Yeah, and ultimately, this is going to be a fight over the embargo. And I would say this is round two of a 15-round bout and one of many bouts over the next few years. I mean, this is not going to be resolved anytime soon.
Yeah.
And I hate to say, not to sound too pessimistic, but I think you see these little fits and starts. But for instance, if Jeb Bush, who is all but running for president, if he wins on his Cuba team, is Lincoln Diaz-Balart as a foreign advisor. So, and they would, I think if he won office, he would immediately kind of ratchet back all these Obama plans, and that we'd be back starting all over again.
Oh, what kind of role do you anticipate this to play, even in the consideration from Governor Bush in his potential run in 2016? And for that matter, Senator Rubio as well. I mean, they're not necessarily talking about Cuba in Iowa and New Hampshire, but they're certainly going to have to talk about it in South Florida.
Yeah, and it'll come up in whatever debates arise during the Republican primary. But it's already a topic, so
yeah.
And especially a topic in Washington. It'll be, you know, it'll be on the list.
Tim, as the nuts and bolts of diplomacy take place in Washington on the official bargaining table, The real action, of course, is usually in the hallways. It's in the hushed tones. It's in the whispers, between the diplomats and their aides.
Right.
That's where we assume that human rights is going to be talked about. That's where we assume more free flow of capital is really going to be talked about. How do we, from the outside, kind of gauge the direction of these negotiations? And for those hardliners that are dead set against any further involvement, how do they interpret what we're going to be hearing on the whispers?
Well, I think you're going to see from the Cuban side, maybe reluctantly, maybe a ratcheting down of mass arrests of dissidents in order, as a card that they can play to get the Obama administration to push harder to get the embargo lifted in Washington. These are the things that once. As I've said before on the show, you've got these, you have to think about it as two levels, the nuts and bolts talks of reestablishing diplomatic ties, and then the larger overarching issues like human rights and the embargo. And, these are the cards that they're going to be playing in order to get these larger issues satisfied on both sides once you've got diplomatic ties reestablished.
Just a couple of weeks ago, we had 3 days of congressional hearings in Washington focused on the first round of talks that happened in Havana. Sergio Bustos, political editor with the Miami Herald, did those congressional hearings, are they going to change the tact at all that the State Department takes in round two?
No, I don't think so. I think those were opportunities for opponents like Senator Marco Rubio and others to at least present their argument to the American public and put it out there. But I don't think it's going to change the State Department's direction at this point. But again, it's a long slog.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a long slog, and it takes day after day, week after week, month after month. But the political reality is that you've got the junior senator from Florida who has been seen as the point person on Cuba. Continued disengagement on the part of the Republicans, work quietly behind the scenes looking for opportunities perhaps to push back against these White House actions. To what success rate, Sergio? To what expectation of success?
Senator Marco Rubio's ability to stop the executive actions are pretty limited.
Yeah.
But again, the bigger elephant in the room is the lifting of the embargo.
Right.
And that's where Senator Mark Rubio has Mitch McConnell in his backing him and other Republican leadership. And remember, the Congress is now both chambers are controlled by Republicans.
Right. And it's important here because Congress is the only body that's going to be able to repeal the trade embargo. That cannot happen by decree from the Oval Office.
And the more realistic thing that could happen on Capitol Hill first might be the lifting of the travel restriction. I think for both the Democrats and Republicans.
Further easing just beyond the 12
categories.
Further easing,
because there really are two components of what only Congress can do here. One is lifting the embargo. That's the biggie. But then the smaller component is lifting the travel restrictions, allowing Americans to go back and forth freely to Cuba as tourists, not just academics and journalists, etc. So I think that those in both parties who support President Obama's new policy on Cuba, I think they're looking at lifting the travel restrictions as sort of a first test as to how realistic this could be for them.
I want to bring these two ideas together with the political chess that goes on in Washington with the final 2 years of the Obama administration, those two issues being immigration reform and, of course, engagement with Cuba. Sergio, put these on the chessboard of policies that the administration wants to put forth in the final 2 years of the administration, in the fourth quarter of the Obama presidency. He does not have to run for reelection again, of course, so he's got to spend whatever political capital he may have over the next 2 years. What's the relationship, though, the political relationship, the calculus that's involved here between the effort to get immigration reform on through Congress in a big way and perhaps something more smaller, but on the administrative side on Cuba that the White House can control without congressional support?
Well, I think in terms of immigration, it's a bigger issue because it affects so many people, and it could play into the hands of Hillary Clinton should she, as we assume, run in 2016. And that would be a major political issue as well. Now, as far as Cuba, I think it'll be lesser so, but again, it'll be one of the top items looking at foreign policy. And look, the Obama administration has already put it out there, so they've made it a priority,
yeah,
both Cuban immigration. But But, you know, with the waning years in his administration and a Republican-controlled Congress, I just don't see much movement. But again, it'll be a big issue come 2016.
And Tim, the Obama administration began 6 years ago with a pledge toward re-engagement with Latin America as a hemisphere, as a continent. We really haven't seen much of that happen at all. And this perhaps is the biggest entree right now, and it's has been greeted how?
Yeah, if you talk to any White House official, they'll tell you that the real impetus behind the change in Cuba policy isn't just U.S.-Cuba relations. It's getting the United States engaged again with Latin America, and Cuba has always been the stumbling block when it comes to that, fairly or not. And I think this is the Obama administration's way of saying, look, this is how we get engaged again with this hemisphere, not just with Cuba.
Through One Island, Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLR, and Sergio Bustos, the political editor at the Miami Herald with us here on the Florida Roundup. Thanks to both of you. Still to come on our program, protecting Florida from the most recent measles outbreak out west. But first, even record cold temperatures pay a visit here to South Florida. Send us your cold weather gear photos. Tweet us at WLRN. Enjoy the cold weather while we can.
No, I live in Miami, so for me this is a treat. I get to wear my winter clothes. We get to get out to be outside and enjoy the night. I think it's fine for one or two nights.
Oh, it's a treat because we don't get this anymore. So it's, you know, and we know it's going to go away in a day or two. It's not going to stay like how the weather does up north. So it's a treat for me.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. 15 years ago, the U.S. declared victory in the fight against measles. The Centers for Disease Control said the virus had been eliminated thanks to a, quote, highly effective measles vaccine and a strong vaccination program that achieves high vaccine coverage in children, end quote. But as we've experienced over the past 3 months, the virus has found its way back to our shores through Disneyland in California. Now, through mid-February, officially according to the CDC, 141 cases have been reported, spread across 17 states, most of those in California where the cases have been concentrated. None have been reported in Florida, but the outbreak has focused a public health debate on vaccines again and the rules around who can avoid or delay them and why. Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell told WLRN it's an education opportunity on public health.
You know, I have a 7- and 5-year-old, and so, you know, the vaccination issue is one that's always been important and one that's front and center for me. As a mother, I believe that's something that's important, and just believe we need to make sure that folks know they're safe and that this is extremely important. And now I think people who did not have measles and didn't understand, this is something you don't want your children or any member of your family to have, and we can stop it.
Miami-Dade County Public School Superintendent Alberto Carvalho says 98% of students in his district have been vaccinated or are getting the shots now.
We've seen recently what the outbreak of measles in Arizona can do to a community. That cannot be the case in Miami. So we are diligent in ensuring that our children are appropriately immunized prior to beginning their school year.
Florida law requires all students are vaccinated unless they have a medical or religious exemption. So have your kids gotten all their shots on time? Have you spread them out? Have you decided not to get some of the shots? What about the neighbor kids? What about the classmates? What are those immunization rules in Florida? Should they be changed? Let us know your thoughts. Parents, teachers, kids, 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. And tweet us at WLRN or go online at WLRN.org. John O'Connor covers education for us here at WLRN. Christina Vega does much the same for the Miami Herald. They both join us here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome to both of you. Christina, talk to us, first of all, about this immunization rate that we heard reported from Superintendent Carvalho. 98% of students vaccinated or are getting the shots now. Does that mean that 2% have no vaccinations, no immunizations?
Well, thanks for having me. Not exactly. And the 98% is probably It's probably more accurate to say that that's the district's compliance rate with making sure that kids have done what they need to do in order to be in school, but they're not necessarily fully vaccinated. Miami-Dade has a really high rate of kids with temporary medical exemptions, which means that they've started their course of immunizations, but they haven't finished it. And that basically speaks to our county is a very transient county with lots of kids coming in and out. So just a note on that, 98%.
It's an important note to make, and John, there's going to be some jargon here. We can't avoid it here. And Christina uses, you know, compliance rate, completed vaccinations. For any parent, you know, vaccinations in the long term is a multi-year process. One isn't completed with the vaccinations until almost you know, young adulthood in some cases. So it's a matter of being up to date. Are these designations important?
Yeah, absolutely. Because one of the issues that we're that's been brought up nationally because of this debate is the idea of why students are being exempted out of the vaccinations. Florida allows for a religious exemption, so parents can say, "Look, I don't want to vaccinate my children for religious reasons." Other states have much broader exemptions. You know, some parents can opt their children out for whatever reason they want, just you know, a personal objection. And so you've seen some states talk about changing that law so that they kind of write out some of these exemptions. So all of these little details, while very technical, do matter. Another thing, as you mentioned too, is that these surveys happen throughout the year. And so, you know, if the health department surveys at the beginning of the school year, those numbers might look a little different than they do in November when a few more students have completed, and they would look even more different in the spring. And so you'll hear a school district say, "Oh, we're at 98% right now," when the state numbers will say 94 or 93. And that's just, you know, sometimes
it's
the school district
in the data.
Yeah,
gathering.
I mean, sometimes the school districts are using the most recent number. But when I think Christina and I use the same numbers here from the state so that we could make comparisons across districts.
Yeah. And so, Christina, when we talk about immunization and talk about exemptions, John mentioned a religious exemption. What other exemptions are out there for Florida parents to use when it comes to immunizations? And how difficult is it to get these exemptions?
The only exemption you can basically choose to have is the religious exemption, and it seems pretty easy in Florida to get that. You basically just sign some paperwork that's available at the health department. And the other exemptions are for temporary medical, which, as I said, are for kids who have started the immunizations but haven't finished them. That's usually for kids who are transferring from other places, not in the state. Mm-hmm. And then there's a 30-day exemption that is basically for kids who are transferring within the state, and it just gives the district some time to confirm that they're up to date.
And Christina, you looked at this data for Miami-Dade and for Broward Public Schools. What are the types of exemptions that parents seem to be using most?
Actually, I wasn't able to get the information for Broward. It was very hard to track down.
Correction,
this information.
Correction, then Miami-Dade, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what we saw in exemptions is Miami-Dade has a very high rate, again, of the temporary medicals. The religious exemptions, it doesn't make up a big portion of the kids in Miami-Dade. It's only 1% here compared to about 1.7 statewide. Mm. But it is growing, and it has gone up basically every year.
John O'Connor, where's the state on this? You know, we've seen California lawmakers talk about tightening up the exemption process. Is this bubbled up now as we're on the eve of the legislative session in Tallahassee?
I have not heard it become a major issue yet. For the most part, Florida is okay on this. You know, we're above the recommended levels for vaccination statewide to prevent this stuff. We're not seeing some of the trends that have happened in California and other states where, you know, a fast growing percentage of parents opting their children out of the vaccination. So right now, when we're talking about education, funding, testing, some of the other issues are higher priority.
Higher priority right now, but we are talking about vaccinations here on the Florida Roundup. 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Send us a tweet at WLRN on Twitter. Parents, teachers, how do you feel about the mandatory immunizations, the schedule of vaccines that one is expected to have for public schools in the state of Florida? Join that conversation again. 800-743-9576. Christy from Miami is on the telephone. Christy, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wanting to respond to the concept of possibly making vaccinations mandatory. And while I am not against vaccinations completely, I don't think that mandatory is the way to go. It seems a little kind of military state, and I'm not so worried so much about autism per se, although, you know, there's always a possibility. But what I'm worried about is that in the past, if you look at the medical history over the ages, so many times the medical establishment will say, and I don't think they're doing it out of evilness, it's just basically given what the studies show at that time, they'll say, no, there's absolutely no risk, it's totally safe. And then 20 or 30 years later, you find out, oh, you know what, that caused a neurological side effect, or it caused this. So I think that it's fair for some folks to still be a little skeptical, and sort of force them seems a little harsh.
Christy, let me ask you a question. I mean, skepticism certainly is fair, but if vaccinations and immunizations are not mandatory, and you know, a situation arises like has arose in California, where you get pockets of children who are not immunized, and the immunization rates fall below what medical science will tell you provides a crowd type of immunization, what then?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny. I've been contemplating this a lot since it's been on the airwaves everywhere you look. I think that it's a funny thing that as Westerners, particularly as Americans, we want to grasp for some sense of security in a world that just isn't very secure. Now, I'm not saying just let it all fly and everyone should get sick, but when we're talking about measles, it seems like it's a treatable illness. It seems like if you pause the hysteria for a second, you can treat this. So most people who have these rare side effects or get blind or the other side effects that come with measles tend to be in places where there's malnourishment and very poor health care.
Well, so, Christy, again, let me ask you. I mean, flu is a treatable disease as well. Should folks not be allowed to have a flu vaccine? Should they choose?
I think that everyone should be allowed. I think they should choose. If someone tried to force me to get a flu vaccine, I'd be very upset. I use homeopathy. Acylococcinum is a wonderful flu remedy. There's a whole slew of alternative and complementary medical therapies out there that help certainly with the flu and definitely with the measles. So it's a tricky concept to talk about forced immunizations, I feel.
Christy, we appreciate the input. Thanks for the thoughts. Christy joining us from Miami, talking about forced immunizations. But Christina Vega with the Miami Herald, these are mandatory vaccines. I mean, for public school kids in the state of Florida, to go to school, they do have to show an immunization record. Isn't that right?
Right. And students can actually be pulled out of class if they don't have the proper immunizations.
They're not going to be pulled out of class to get a shot, but they're just going to be pulled out of class.
Until they get the proper immunization.
Right?
Other thing to remember about, you know, this question of forced immunizations, some people can't get immunized. Some people are sick, they have compromised immune systems, they have cancer. And so public health officials say that it's important that everyone else gets immunized to protect those people who are most at risk. And also the public health officials who I spoke to for my story, they all pointed out that, you know, with the measles, 1 in 5 kids is going to have a serious reaction mm-hmm. to that. On the other hand, another public health official who I spoke to said that the serious consequences from vaccines are so rare that he compared it to 1 million people get a shot, one walks out and gets hit by a bus. Was that caused by the shot? We don't really know.
There's causation and correlation, but that we'll leave that for another scientific discussion here. 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Christina, you've looked at some of the immunization data here in South Florida. We talked about a 98% compliance rate in Miami-Dade. What do we know about the ages of students who are perhaps not getting vaccinated or immunized on schedule, or where are they in their school lives?
Actually, Miami-Dade right now has a pretty high compliance rate. It's probably higher than 98%. They're doing a really good job of keeping track of which kids are up to date and which kids aren't. The data that I looked at focused on kindergartners. The state breaks it up by kindergartners in seventh grade because kids are required to have their shots by those two different milestones. And immunization rates among seventh graders was a little higher. Hmm. Among kindergartners in Miami-Dade, it's about 92%, according to the state, at, again, that one static point in time that they looked at it.
Is there anything, John, that perhaps Miami-Dade in South Florida could kind of teach the rest of the world, given the transitory population that we do have here and the large immigrant population, coupled with the pretty large compliance rate that we have on immunizations?
I mean, I don't think that this is any kind of mystery as to how to take care of this as a public health issue. You know, the kids
get a shot.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, you need yeah. to reach out. You need to, you know, generally, the research has shown that the two populations that are least likely to get vaccinated are the very rich and the very poor.
Hmm.
And so, you know, Miami-Dade, the school district has mentioned this, that they are helping folks who can't afford the shots to go find places that will provide them for free. You know, it's no real mystery here. What is interesting, though, is, you know, if you have people who don't want to get shots, you know, it generally education isn't going to help in that issue, because
right.
the more evidence you present to them, the more you tell them this is what science says, you know, it does not change their mind on the issue.
It's an emotional response, not a scientific response.
Yeah, there was a really great series of stories written this week by a healthcare reporter named Tara Hale, H-A-E-L-L-E, on Forbes. And she went through kind of myths about anti-vaccination folks. And it's really interesting to look at just the broad scope of why people come to this decision as to not to yeah. immunize their child.
Let's go back to the phones. Alfredo joining the conversation here on the Florida Roundup from Miami. Alfredo, go ahead. Welcome.
Hi guys. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Very happy you guys are talking about this today. So what I've seen, and I've seen this beyond, and I'm a medical professional, and I've seen it beyond just immunizations. There seems to be this social phenomenon happening with regard to what I call Facebook medicine. Essentially, people are taking a lot of their cues and are getting a lot of information from very, very questionable sources. And I've seen people who are actually in the scientific community that have not immunized their kids or had questions or doubts about immunizing their kids, despite decades of information showing how little risk there is in terms of immunization and how incredibly dangerous some of these diseases that we're trying to immunize against are in pandemic situations. So that's just my comment on this. I think it tends to bleed into other things like climate change and other things where there's just essentially people keep seeing it on social media. It must be real because this person that I like is posting it.
Practicing Facebook medicine, dangerous, according to Alfredo. Good phrase there, joining the conversation here from Miami. Let's go to Russ in Miramar. He's on the phone here for the Florida Roundup. Welcome, Russ. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to stick to a couple of facts. I've been doing research on autism for about 20 years or so, and one of the things which I have unpublished research I've seen is if you go to the state records, it takes a little bit of work, but if you go to the state records and compare the measles, mumps, rubella immunization rates on most states in this country, and you compare them to the autism rates for children, you will find a very interesting correlation. It starts the percentage of autism.
Correlation, though, Russ, and I got it. Correlation in no way shows as causation, and the published research on this, in fact, does lead us to that conclusion. So thank you for that. Henry from Boynton Beach joining the program. Go ahead, Henry.
Hey, I'm just calling to hear the input of your panelists as concerns public education as a public service as opposed to a right. If someone wants to compromise the public health by not using vaccines, which scientifically have been proven time and again to work, at what point does it become our responsibility to the students who aren't doing that to say, maybe we should put you in separate classrooms, or maybe we shouldn't provide you with that service.
It's an interesting point, Henry, and it's one actually that I know Northern California, John, is really having because of this outbreak and because of the pockets of kids that aren't immunized in some wealthy enclaves, talking about providing separate classrooms for children who aren't and separate classrooms for children who are, but it still gets down to the blanket immunity that happens at certain compliance levels.
Yeah, I mean, you're even seeing patients put pressure on doctors to not allow children who haven't been immunized into their offices.
Right.
So you're seeing it both public and private sector there. Similar conversation in Colorado, which has one of the loosest vaccination requirements. You know, they're talking about changing that. I think with this issue in Florida, because it's not at that point yet, because vaccination rates here are high enough that it, you know, it's still above what public health officials recommend, that folks don't want to have that conversation yet because they don't need to have that conversation yet.
John O'Connor covering education, Christina Vega covering education for the Miami Herald. Thanks to both of you as we dive into vaccinations and immunizations here in the Sunshine State. Still to come on our program, powering Florida homes and keeping them warm with sunshine. But first, when you come to Florida for a break from winter, even the record cold here can still feel plenty warm.
People dress warmer than I dress for minus 30 here. It's crazy. I didn't even know they made material this thick in Florida.
The weather has been fantastic. I've been wearing flip-flops and dresses and skirts all week so far.
We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. So it's cold out, but it's still sunny here in the Sunshine State. South Florida has sunshine about 250 days per year. In fact, Florida is third in the nation for the potential of solar energy, but it's 18th in capturing the sun's rays for power. Tens of thousands of Floridians want the state to turn it up, though. 100,000 people have signed a petition to put a proposed constitutional amendment up to a statewide vote. The idea is to make it easier for people using solar panels to generate electricity and then sell that power directly to other people. Ivan Penn writes about it this week in the Tampa Bay Times, and he joins us from Tampa Bay. Ivan, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Florida does generate some electricity from the sun, doesn't it?
That's right. Right now, the largest solar utility-scale solar project is actually owned and operated by Florida Power and Light. And then you also have a number of commercial and, of course, some residential consumers who have solar panels on their rooftops.
And those residential consumers are really what the focus of this proposed constitutional amendment is, because right now you can only generate solar energy that you use, right? The consumer that has the solar panels can only use that energy. Nobody else can.
They have to use it themselves, and any excess can be sold back to the grid, but not to another consumer.
So how does this effort, and we'll talk about who's behind the effort in a moment, but what is the target of this effort, the goal of this constitutional effort, this proposal that has already garnered 100,000 signatures?
Well, the essence of it is to overcome that barrier of being able to generate solar and then sell that power to another consumer. So take, for example, say a Publix grocery store, for example, owned an entire strip mall. Publix could not put solar on the rooftop of that entire strip mall and then sell power to, say, a dry cleaners who's in that shopping mall.
That would put Publix in the power business in direct competition against Duke Energy in your neighborhood and FPL in our neighborhood here.
That's correct. And under Florida law, that's illegal.
And the effort by this amendment is to change Florida law, correct?
That's right. So what this amendment would do is to allow landlords of whatever stripe to put solar panels on the rooftop of the property they own and then sell that power directly to their tenant. And that, of course, does put that person or a company in direct competition with the utilities.
Yeah, because 70% of power, of electricity generated by FPL now is generated via natural gas. Somebody owns natural gas. Another quarter comes from atomic energy. Somebody owns that atomic energy. Nobody owns the power of the sun. And that gets to the heart of this matter. Who's behind this effort that's, again, gained 100,000 signatures in, what, about 2 months now?
That's right. So you have a couple of major drivers. One is a group called Conservatives for Energy Freedom, and they have teamed up with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and along with a few other groups, formed a coalition that they've dubbed Floridians for Solar Choice. That coalition now has drawn the attention of a variety of both conservatives, libertarians, and of liberals, and now has a very unusual group of people that cross the political spectrum.
Yeah, it's a really odd coalition, as you just mapped out there, from that kind of three-legged stools of conservatives, of really free market libertarians, and then environmentalists that are tend to lean more liberal in their political philosophies. And partly because, Ivan, perhaps the proposed amendment really is focused on the market as opposed to clean energy or the environmental benefits of solar energy versus other fossil fuel-generated electricity.
Right, and you're not talking about, in this petition, you're not talking about any tax increases, any subsidies. So you've got all of these different players who have found a common ground that they can all stand on and really have locked arms. And I mean, it's been fascinating watching the different kinds of groups that keep signing on almost really week after week.
Yeah, yeah. Can it stick together enough to get this amendment on the ballot?
Well, what they'll need is 683,149 signatures to get it on the 2016 ballot. In the amount of time that they've been operating to accumulate 100,000 signatures, you know, it's a pretty strong showing for their effort. Now, that's how many signatures that they've gathered, but then those signatures also have to be verified
right
by the supervisors of elections that these are actually valid petitions. And typically, you have anywhere from 20% to 25% of the petitions that are invalidated.
So it's still got quite a ways to go before it's going to show up actually on the statewide ballot. But in our final moment here, Ivan Penn with Tampa Bay Times, as it looks to move forward, we saw this with the medical marijuana constitutional amendment, which failed to reach the 60% threshold. It did push action, legislative action in Tallahassee. Could this push legislative action in the Capitol this session?
Well, that's going to be sort of the major issue here, because there was a feeling in Tallahassee that there is more of a supply issue, in that, you know, people would like to see more clean energy as opposed to a demand issue of people wanting. I really want this on my rooftop.
Right.
With this petition, even if it were not successful, a large number of signatures could really show that there is a demand.
We'll see where it goes. Ivan Penn covering the situation on solar energy in a new proposed constitutional amendment for the Tampa Bay Times. Finally on the roundup this week, why is the sky turning pink? That's what my six-year-old asked me as we watched one of the TV weather forecasts this week. We were on the couch in shorts and T-shirts just back from the zoo with Grandma, who was visiting. The weather map zoomed out from our little slice of land, jutting out like the thumb of the continent, showing a mass of pink oozing out of Canada into the upper Midwest, where the six-year-old was born. But he was too young when we moved here to remember snow boots, too young to remember mittens, too young to know the deep chill early in the morning running through your body when your alarm clock beckons and school or work demands you rise and leave the thermal comfort of that thick blanket for the cold, hard reality of a tile floor. The weather forecaster put the map in motion. That Canadian pink, it started to spill out of the Great Lakes. The three-day, four-day, five-day forecast, the pink was marching through the eastern half of America, sparing no one.
Thermostats were checked. Switches were flipped. Heaters, what we call furnaces up north, were ignited. The pink first overtook Chicago, pushing out the familiar reds and oranges. Memphis turned white. Atlanta was conquered. Jacksonville was overrun. South Florida lost its grip on yellow and was struggling to stay a shade of green that can only be appropriately described as key lime. First, the long sleeves and pants. That wasn't enough. Soon enough, it was sweaters. Sandals were put away. We had to wear shoes with socks. Thick socks, maybe even boots. But the pink kept coming. Jackets were found deep in the closet. They were lonely and dusty, but they were warm and ready for duty again. Seat warmers. This is why automakers put them in. How do I turn off the AC in the car again? I feel pink. I want to be red, or at least a pleasant shade of yellow. What's that? Oh, yeah. My son assures me we'll be orange again by next week. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. Thanks to everybody who called and tweeted. It's produced by Julia Duba and Steph Farrow. Our news director is Terrence Shepard, digital editor Maria Muriel. Our executive producer is Peter J. Mertz, and technical supervisor Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. I wish every day the sun would shine. Take me to another place in my life where everything is